Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois. Delighted to be back for another episode of Christ the Center. If you're watching the video, some things might look a little weird or different. That's because we've got a special episode today. I'm all decked out in my Chicago Cubs gear, and I have with me, to witness me in my glory and splendor, is Jim Cassidy, who serves as pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. And Jim defiles the central place, the most excellent place in our studio here, which literally is quite in the middle of all the rooms of the studio, and he defiles it by coming in not with the robes of the high priest, but with Mets gear.
Yeah, this is less outward glory, and but still, nevertheless, glorious. We'll see tonight. Yeah.
We're both pathetic. both of our teams are pathetic. And, you know,
some more pathetic than others.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. We have a good time joking around, and we are going to a Chicago Cubs or Mets game, depending on your perspective.
But it's a Mets game.
They're playing tonight down at Wrigley Field. Jim is in studio this week because he's been teaching a course for Reformed Academy on John chapters 1-10. So we just finished that. He finished that like 45 minutes ago. And it was a wonderful course. I'm looking forward to watching and seeing it all as I edit it. Ryan was tending to all the details while I was handling some other things. But what I did hear and what I did see was tremendous. And we're looking forward to getting that out ASAP. So as it stands right now, we have, I believe, three courses in the can that need to be edited and published. There are various stages of production. The last two in the Van Til series, Van Til 7, Van Til 8, Van Til 7, you're on. You taught some lectures on Van Til's interpretation of Karl Barth, along with Lane Tipton. And then Van Til 8, Lane Tipton finished off on the subject of idealism. So really fascinating. A lot of interesting things going on there. And I'm looking forward to getting all those out the door so that everyone can watch and listen. And then very soon getting this John course. You mind giving an introduction or a little bit of a spiel for the John course? Who is it targeted towards? What were you trying to accomplish? And, you know, how are you pitching this particular material for a particular group of students?
Yeah, I was probably trying to accomplish way too much in what I really had. So it's really an overview. And I'm taking one chapter at a time. So there are 10 lessons covering chapters 1-10. And as you know, a lot of those chapters can be lengthy. So it's basically an overview of each chapter in the course of 30 minutes each chapter. So you can only really say so much, but hopefully it's a helpful introduction. I'm hoping to give some hermeneutical keys that will help people to interpret the Gospel of John on their own, kind of like what I did with the Job course, really, you know, very broad overview, but with the goal of helping people to become better interpreters of the scriptures as they approach the book on their own. It's very accessible. I'm targeting lay people mostly, but I'm also getting into some deeper issues on occasion, just touching on them very briefly, that I believe will be stimulating for even more mature believers who are seeking to grow in their understanding of the theology of John. And that's really what it is. It's a theology of John. And in that sense, it's an overview, hopefully giving some hermeneutical helps to people to read on their own better.
I'm really excited about it. I appreciate that. We continue to develop these Bible study courses that are targeted towards adult Bibles, adult Sunday school people, people that want to engage in a Bible study or small group. Of course, a lot of these are applicable to high schoolers too. Certainly could be used by a range of ages, but by targeting just a general audience with these Bible study courses, we're seeking to broaden our base. We're seeking to be more helpful to the broader church and provide an entree or an on-ramp to some of our more advanced courses. So while we have things that are on very deep and specific technical aspects of Trinitarian theology and philosophy, that sort of thing, we never want to stop doing that, but we also want to make sure that we are providing resources for the whole church and slowly building this out. So we have, I don't know, four or five of these Bible study courses already done and looking to cover the entire Bible in the in the near future. It's going to take some time, but we're doing 10 to 12, well, about 10 courses a year now.
So, that's great. Wow.
Yeah, on a variety of subjects, but we're cruising. Like Ryan's doing tremendous work and getting guys scheduled. Mm-hmm. We bring them in. We show them a good time so that they want to come back. We're going to this Cubs game tonight. So you paid me for my ticket, so thanks for that. So, and I have yet to forward the ticket to you on your app, so I need to do that. But we're looking forward to going down there and taking care of some business.
We'll see. Can I give a quick shout out? So, because we're talking about those Bible courses.
Amen.
If our listeners have not yet had a chance to listen to Dan Ragusa's class and Mark Winder's class, those two classes are tremendous. I had a chance to listen to those at Reformed Academy, and both of those brothers do such a good job and very edifying, informative, just theologically rich and deep. So let me commend those to our listeners.
Yeah, they're amazing. They're really well done. They're rich. So don't think that since it's a Sunday school course, you're going to miss out, that if you've cut your teeth on redemptive historical hermeneutics and theology that you're going to be bored. You're not. I mean, it's wonderful material. It's really rich, but at the same time, accessible to people who aren't familiar with those things. So those guys, especially in your course on Job, also really hit the mark in having a wider, you know, accessibility, but without compromising the depth and the richness and the theological perspective and focus that we're trying to present here. Because there's a lot of other materials on the on books of the Bible. You can go to a lot of places if you just want a Bible study book, but you can't go anywhere else if you want something that is richly redemptive historical, coming from our very specific and thoroughly consistent Vossian perspective. That's something that we're uniquely presenting, which is why we believe it's important that we do this work and that people would come alongside us to support it, and that we have people who are willing to come and teach it. So that's what we're all about, and looking forward to getting into those things and continuing the work in months and years to come. We had a great time last night. We went out to dinner. You had what, four lessons, I think you did today, maybe five. And you know, last night we needed to go eat, so we went out and had a nice dinner. But at that dinner, we also got talking about some fun stuff. So I thought it'd be fun if we got into the studio today. As it stands right now, as we record, it is Tuesday, May 23rd. So you can look and you'll already find out how the Cubs and Mets did playing against each other. Hopefully it was a complete game and we don't have any rainouts. Weather's looking fine. Shouldn't be a problem. No riots. Maybe you're not going to start a riot, are you? No, hopefully not.
It'd be great, though, if there was a brawl on the field. That'd be fun to watch. Yeah.
you really wanted the cup snake.
I want the cup snake that happens usually out in the bleachers, but that'd be great.
We're not in the bleachers, so we can watch it, though, if we see one. But I bring this up because I believe, as I look at the calendar, this episode might air around June 2nd, if that's a Friday, I think. So these things are still rather timely. But there's a lot of talk in the world. I listen to quite a few business podcasts on different subjects, tech podcasts, and everyone's talking about artificial intelligence. And, you know, I've been playing around with it. I use it for various things, and I think it's fascinating. It's also philosophically concerning to a degree, depending on where things go. You and I obviously have a certain theological anthropology, and we believe the Bible teaches certain things about, I believe that gives us guidelines about what is and what isn't possible. But that doesn't mean that there are no dangers or concerns with the technology that could theoretically run amok and do something we didn't intend for it to do. Obviously, that's a possibility, and maybe we'll talk about some of those things. But what we were talking about more specifically last night was just the practical application of a tool such as ChatGPT and how that might affect scholarship, how it will inevitably affect how we engage in pastoral training in seminaries, how we assess people and their suitability for the ministry, how we grade people to see if they're ready and capable to move on to advanced subjects, and also how we engage in scholarship and how we analyze scholarship and what does it mean to be an author? You know, where are lines crossed? Where is something plagiarism? Where is something co-authorship? Where is something, you know, having artificial editing? You know, there's all sorts of interesting questions there. And then we got into all sorts of questions about the ethics of pastoral ministry you know, with the assistance or replacement of artificial intelligence. So I was hoping we could revisit that. I don't know if we'll get as fired up as we were last night. Maybe we will. I'll try to insult you a few times. Maybe we can get going on some.
Anyway.
Yeah, you know, I can't help myself. But you know, there are a lot of questions to ask, and you know, where are the lines drawn? Where should they be drawn? Should they be completely banned using a tool such as ChatGPT? What if it gave you a sermon illustration? You described a point that you needed an illustration for, and it came up with an example, or you asked for some suggestions for hymns on a certain subject. Is that okay? Okay, I think we see some usefulness there. But what if it did your entire sermon outline? What if it did more than that? You know,
what if it did your sermon?
What if it did your whole sermon? Yeah. And it could. Right. Mm-hmm. And what if it did your entire order of worship? Like mm-hmm. It picked all your verses and everything. It did the call to worship, the call to confession, whatever you've got in the service. These are questions that. These aren't just speculative questions. You know, these are addressing the church is encountering these issues right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worthwhile for us to take a moment to talk about it and mm-hmm. and get into it. So I don't know, some of this might be a little artificial, no pun intended, to begin with, since we're already kind of in the middle of a conversation and have already chatted about some of these things. But just to revisit some of this for the sake of the listeners, mm-hmm. I think it's worthwhile to rewind our conversation as much as we can and try to replay it to a degree.
Yeah.
So just to start, what's your experience with AI in general or ChatGPT? Have you been hearing about it? Have you been using tools? Have you been perusing a bunch of tools? Like, where are you with these this new frontier?
Well, first of all, I mean, I have to say that I'm artificially intelligent. So let's get that one out of the way. And when it comes to
organically stupid,
organically stupid, artificially intelligent, that's about where I'm at this point. When it comes to the technology, I really am organically stupid. So I really have no clue. I mean, I dabbled a little bit with the online, you know, version of this thing that was free, and I wasn't particularly entertained by it. So I moved on to other things. And in our discussion last night, you were explaining the technological side of it, which was exceedingly helpful for me because I didn't understand exactly the way in which it works and the way that it could work, the way that it could go amok and so forth and so on. And the way actually that it could be, what I walked away from in our conversation last night, I think, is how it can be used as a tool, how mm-hmm. there is the potential of proper use of this thing mm-hmm. for the aid of scholarship or even of ministry, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. So, my experience with it hands-on is like nil. So, yeah.
Well, we were playing around with it. You gave it a question. What was the BART question you gave it? I said, why don't you toss out a question here on BART scholarship? Yeah. Let's see what comes back.
Right. So I asked, what is the relationship between BART's actualistic ontology and his doctrine of justification?
So it gave an okay answer. It wasn't a bad answer. It was kind of well-rounded, kind of vanilla. And then I asked it, give me some sources on something I could read on this topic. Gave us five or six books and articles. They were things we might expect, some things I didn't know about, but other things that I would guess would be on that list. It's fascinating. That even that in its own right, just if that's all we had and that's all it could do, is still amazing and useful. But it can go beyond
and time-saving.
Yeah. And time-saving. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So to back up a little bit, I used to computer program. I still do some programming here and there to accomplish specific tasks I need to have done. I've actually used ChatGPT to write me some bash scripts that I've been having trouble getting to work. Some nerds out there will know what I'm talking about and they'll appreciate what I've been doing. It's wonderful for that. It's wonderfully useful. I've also been using it for other things, more advanced things, and trying to push the limits of it to see what's possible. Just to kind of get my head around what is going on with this and think about things, just to get a broader view of the potential frontier, the potential benefits and advantages to humanity and to the church, but also the potential dangers and ethical quandaries that inevitably will arise. So I might have a better technical grasp of some things than most people, than a lot of people that might listen to this program, but in no way, shape, or form do I really know anything what I'm talking about with AI specifically.
Sure.
But at a layman's level, A lot of this technology, some of it can be traced back to an organization, an initiative inside of Google called DeepMind, I believe. And again, check my sources, have ChatGPT compare the transcript of this to whatever's online, and it'll tell you whether I'm accurate or not.
Spit out a rebuke for Mr. Busey, please.
I should just have, I should run the ChatGPT app while we're talking and have it do this kind of stuff as we're joking along. Again, I can't tell you how things work or why things work, but I can give you a layman's explanation as best I know of how some of this works. And that helps us get a sense of what's going on right now. It doesn't mean this is the way things are going to work in the future. But right now, when we're dealing with GPT, ChatGPT is an interface to GPT. And there are many programs out there. Google has one called Bard. Microsoft Bing, I believe, is integrating with to GPT. These are called large language models, LLMs. So just, this is overly simplistic, but just imagine feeding, you know, an enormous amount of text, like the internet, all the books. Like imagine trying to take all of human production, in English at least, and dumping it into a database, at least up till 2021. GPT right now is limited to, I think, sometime in 2021, so it can't do necessarily current events. But now the interface will take a textual input, so you can ask it a question, you can ask it to do something. But basically what it does in hyper-simplistic terms is it functions and it tries to figure out what the next most probable word is in a sequence. So based on what you ask, it'll take that input, run it through its program, run it through its equation, and then figure out what the most likely word is next. That goes through something called like a transformer to a degree. There's a technology called a transformer. And it's all, and what they've done with GPT is to stack transformers on one another. So after it gets the first most probable word, then it runs all that output back through the process again, and it tries to get the next most probable word in the sequence. And it just goes from there. It just spits out sequential words.
That makes sense to us.
The way we interpret it is that this thing is smart and it's communicating to us in human language.
Yeah.
If we boil it all down, what it's doing is it basically has an immensely complicated polynomial equation, you know, like a squared plus b squared equals c squared. But imagine like 10,000 dimensions or variables within that equation weighted a certain way and then running all of human production or as much of human language production as possible through it to come up with the right probabilities. So some people might think that what it does is it goes on the internet with your question and copies and pastes things and stitches it together. That's not at all what it's doing. It's creating and generating new text that doesn't exist anywhere else.
Wow.
But it's doing it based on, again, oversimplistically, just figuring out the probable next word and then just continually running that chain.
Wow.
From there, it can do amazing things. On the way back from Presbytery, just for fun, with some the guys I was riding with, we were asking it the questions from the floor exam. And it passed. Like it did a better job on some questions than some of our candidates. I'm not
Reverend AI. Yeah.
Reverend AI, yeah. Pastor AI, licentiate AI did fine.
Yeah.
Like sometimes it's repetitive. Sometimes, you know, it could be tweaked, but basically you can even get around those problems once you learn how to ask it things correctly. You can prompt it with how to use, what style to use, what to do, what not to do. Basically, you can coach it by getting better at asking it questions.
That's
right. And as you develop your own prompts and perfect them, it will learn, quote, learn, and then spit out answers more to your liking. What you can't do is just be very general and vague and then expect it to read your mind. But I have found that if I treat ChatGPT, especially the latest version that's out right now, GPT-4, if I treat it like a very capable intern or a very capable research assistant whom I should not expect knows anything. It's kind of counterintuitive because someone who's very capable, you would expect would have some preceding knowledge. But imagine someone is going to be your research assistant, you know, they're extremely bright and resourceful, but this is day one of their job.
Yep.
Like day one. Mm-hmm. I found that if I talk to it like that, and if, even if I'm polite and I use polite language, it like affects the way I interact with it. Like if I'm nice to it and treat it nicely, like they get good results. Now they're not perfect, but they're a heck of a lot better than any research assistant I can afford, and a heck of a lot faster.
Right.
So there's the question. Yep. So I don't know. I mean, what are your initial thoughts on that before we start getting into some of the thornier issues and use cases?
Yeah. So that was helpful. I think that was a helpful explanation, and I kind of dispelled a lot of the myths, I guess, I had about it, in part because my impression was that it scoured the internet and it found text that had to do with, you know, what you were asking it, and then just, like you said, copy and pasted it. I also had the impression, this is leading into some of the ethical problems that might arise. I also had the impression that the way in which it could be, I'll put it differently, the way in which it would be used or had to be used was, you know, you gave it a question and it spat back out an essay or let's say a paper.
It can.
Right. It can. Yeah. Right. But it need not. And that's where initially I thought this thing has no redeeming quality, only problems to come. Right. Because it's like, you're envisioning high school and college kids.
Yeah.
Feeding questions.
That's over.
And
It's already over.
It's already happening, right? So and then all it's doing is writing papers for people, and that means that to use it means, and this came up in our discussion, to use it is a form of plagiarism.
That's where we got
my impression. Yeah.
That's where we got into a bit of an argument.
Yeah.
I might be a little bit more particular about my use of the word plagiarism. Mm-hmm. And that can be, you can have a narrow view. It can have a wider view. It can be plagiarism, but you're not plagiarizing a thing, or a person.
Yeah.
I mean, so there are different ways to use the tool. This is where it gets really hairy. You can use it like rocket fuel to improve your writing. I've been using it at times, you know, I'll take a block of my own writing, completely original, my own thoughts, and say, you know, fix this for style, clarity, readability, tighten it up, improve it. You know, these aren't the exact prompts I would use, but this is basically what I'm trying to tell it. And it'll spit it back to me, like a better version of what I wrote. And then I can look at that and I edit it. Now, is that wrong? Like, I'm totally cool with doing that. I don't mind it. It's like having an intelligent, smart editor that I'm working with.
Yeah.
They're my own thoughts. Yeah, right. But it gets into a bit of a gray area when we're talking about certain things. Because, you know, although I worked with and generated all the thoughts, so to speak, and created a work with a tool at my side and my fingertips, and I edited it, like there certainly might be words or turns of phrases in there, those sorts of things that did not come out of my head directly. All right. Now that might bother people, and there might be places where that's unacceptable. So it kind of, I don't want to be a contextualist or a situational ethicist, but it's different, I think. Mm-hmm. Doing something like that to improve an email I'm writing to somebody, mm-hmm. or let's say I'm writing a letter or, I don't know, writing some notes to myself, or am I developing an article or a blog post? That's a great example, a blog post. You know, let's say I sketch out some ideas, I work out the logic, I expand on these things and whatnot, and then I ask my artificial editor to improve the language and spit this back, give me some ideas of other things I might explore, and then I engage in an interactive, you know, exchange with this tool to improve what I've been working on. I personally don't have any ethical problems with using it in that way. Although I would not want anyone to be doing that for an exam they're turning into me if I'm under the impression that they're doing this themselves. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
In the same way, like I wouldn't want someone to just go home and like, let's say I'm grading, I'm teaching a seminary course and I've assigned a paper and, you know, some guys getting, you know, help from another student, you know, on developing more than just helping him speak his own thoughts clearly, but actually writing portions for him, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So it gets real complicated real right. fast.
Well, one of the things, you know, and I appreciate that about the editor, I think that that's a good kind of parallel or illustration to help us analyze this in a more level-headed kind of way. And if it's doing editing work and improving your writing, mm-hmm. then I think that, that's got merit to it. Mm-hmm. But here's my question, and this didn't come up last night in our yeah. discussion, so it's sort of a new one, kind of going off of this editor idea. So at what point does it edit your work so well that there's no longer the authentic Camden Busey in, right. in the text, right? Because you have a voice, right? Yeah. We talk about our voice. And oftentimes the way that we speak gets reflected in the way
I'm going to blow your mind now. Now you're going to get real depressed because there are ways to feed it a whole bunch of your own writing and say, emulate, write this in my voice.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So it can rewrite it without losing your authenticity. So it's sort of.
It gets, I've just made things. I haven't solved the problem for you. I just made it more yeah. complicated.
Yeah. No, it is more.
You could emulate
yeah.
somebody else's voice if you wanted.
Right.
If you had enough.
That's a real input. Problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see it perhaps less of an ethical problem for it to emulate my own voice because you preserve the authenticity then there, right? Because if you know Camden Busey and then you pick up a book of his and you read it and you go, that doesn't sound like Camden. And well, lo and behold, it wasn't Camden. It was really the voice
Camden's,
of AI.
Camden's in ChatGPT.
Yeah, right. And it's kind of like, well, you kind of lose that authenticity. And you read a book and then you meet a person, you're like, kind of like, well, you know, the way that you wrote in the book is not really the way in which you really are. Mm. Now, as somebody with a really bad Jersey accent who, you know, struggles with sort of articulation on the fly, I'm really glad, you know, that my writing doesn't emulate my speaking, yeah. the voice of my speaking. Like I have, you know, in the one book I published, I yeah. have really good editors that help me to look better than to sound better than what I really am. And that's where your analogy, I think, strikes me as a very good, helpful analogy.
You're right.
If it's editing to improve a piece of text,
right,
just like a human would, but faster.
I think
have no
that's
problems with that ethically.
A helpful place to start, because before we pile on or onto GPT and say this is horrible, we should never use these tools. It's not ethical. I think we need to pause as a collective,
society.
As this listener base.
Yeah.
And let us explain how things happen already. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I don't know of any reformed publishers that engage in ghostwriting.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they don't. Mm-hmm. I don't like the idea of ghostwriting unless, mm-hmm. you know, it's known or explained. If somebody's really ghostwriting something with the help of like somebody famous, like it's a biography of a CEO or something, or Andre Agassi's biography is ghostwritten. We know who ghost wrote it. I don't remember his name, but I think it's the same guy who wrote Prince Harry's. Now that one doesn't have the ghostwriter on the cover, but it's well known that this guy did it.
Interesting.
Usually when yeah. you see a book and it says, you know, somebody is the author and then it says with
right.
So that's, and so that's a ghostwriter.
Right. Yeah.
If it's just two names, then they're co-authors.
Right.
If it's with somebody, that means basically the with guy, he did the writing. The other guy probably supplied the content or, you know, reviewed it all. So they probably had a whole bunch of interviews,
right.
talks.
Or at least this is the
ghostwriter went
books.
Away, wrote it, and yeah. then the main guy came back and said, yeah, this is fine. This
right.
is okay.
Right.
That's how the ghostwriting works.
Interesting.
But even with a straight up normal theology book, there can be all sorts of different levels of editing that happen.
Sure.
Some guys might come in with a completed manuscript and the editor will go through and basically just do copy editing where you're looking at grammatical structures or even just looking for typos, misspellings, grammatical mistakes, formatting errors, and making sure all that's well and good. I don't think anyone would be surprised about that or see that somehow takes away from the authorship, right?
Right.
Like if I wrote something that had grammatical mistakes, someone else fixed them on their own, and then it was published, no one thinks, oh, I'm not the author of that.
Right.
Right. That's the way things work.
Sure.
Now you can have editors that are more like managing editors. And I think different companies and different industries, even fields might use different topics, but you might have someone who's more of like an architect. Mm-hmm. And those editors are invaluable, but they might come in and say, oh, I see what you have here. Or somebody comes in with ideas or a sketch or maybe even a worked out manuscript. But this architect type editor might be saying, I really think you need to move this chunk over here. You need to put chapter 2 at chapter 5 and write a new chapter here that addresses this. They might even go to the lengths of giving them like an outline or bullet points of here's the kinds of things I think you need to address, and then handing it back and the person works on it. There might even be more where somebody's like fixing somebody's sentences that stink, you know, where somebody's writing sentences that maybe aren't as clear. Some editors will make a change and track changes, and then you can accept or reject it as your own. Some people, I presume, are probably just under the arrangement where the editor just goes in there and cleans it up.
Yeah.
And the author doesn't care. Just, yeah, right. I trust you. Go fix it.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we're starting to get into maybe not totally gray areas, but areas in which some people might not understand that many of the books they read and love are already constructed that way.
Yeah. And what the AI is doing is just accelerating that process.
Yeah.
And doing it, I don't know what the proper way of maybe, saying is, but right. Electronically.
We haven't got to the point where the AI is actually like doing right. The heavy lifting for you. It can to a degree.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think it's to the point where it can pass, you know, scholarly criticism. And that's kind
of
where we had
maybe some more of our,
yeah,
you know, hitting, you know, sure. Points where we were rubbing up against each other was
sure.
The issue of, you know, higher scholarship and how much of the artificial intelligence is doing scholarly work and you're right. Just sort of pushing buttons.
Well, before, yeah, as a segue to that,
mm-hmm.
Let me also explain a little bit of how some of the scholarship works. Now, yep. most seminaries can't afford this, but it's not unusual if a seminary could, or if a guy is a senior or significant of enough scholar, he will have research assistants. And then research assistants might be in the budget, but research assistants can do a variety of things. Some guys use them as teaching assistants and might just have them grading papers, doing that. But some guys, guys that are well-known and loved in our field, and this is not, I mean, it's maybe a bit unusual just for monetary reasons, but this is a known scholarly practice.
Sure.
Where a senior scholar might have a research assistant or two or three, and then assign them tasks. Mm-hmm. And say, hey, I'm interested in writing a paper or starting a book on such and such topic. I want you to go out there, research this topic, come up with an annotated bibliography of potential sources, compile those sources for me, format them in this way, come back to me, suggest this. They might even go to other, even greater lengths and say, you know, sketch out some thoughts on this or what do you think? Give me a brief, give me an abstract of, you know, the summary literature. The research assistant will go do that, provide those resources. Then the senior scholar will take all the resources his assistants have compiled and then start working. But he, you know, he'll eventually, you hope, go back and read those sources himself, but he's being provided a leg up, an initial shortcut to know where to spend his time. I found that GPT is phenomenal at, well, phenomenal is too strong of a word. It's very good at doing that very quickly. Like it's not going to be comprehensive. It's not going to find everything, but just for a quick, you know, even something that I would give to a research assistant and ask them to do this in 2 or 3 hours, I can get something back better than what they could do in the span of 5 or 10 seconds.
Yeah. That's remarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if it's again, just sort of like the way in which it can operate like a human editor, but mm-hmm. more efficiently, let's say, right. Or quickly, if it's operating as a research assistant in that way, where it's gathering together mm-hmm. resources, articles, books mm-hmm. in a bibliographical format or whatever, so that the person who is actually going to do the research and the writing has all of that at their fingertips. They know where to begin. They're not sort of spending hours over at the computer catalog and typing in, you know, search criteria.
Right.
It just like that. You know, it, I don't see anything unethical in that at all.
Sure. But now we start to get into the question of, let's, before we get in the question of assessment for, you know, universities and seminaries and how we actually need to be grading and figuring out.
Can I just say something real, before you go there real quick, just on the last point? I think this is important to note. And this is really what I took away from last night's conversation was I didn't realize that. I would suggest that a lot, I would guess that a lot of our listeners don't have that notion of AI, GPT, right? Where it can operate in this way, where it become, where it is a tool, not a substitute.
Yeah.
I think most, I mean, well, at least I might. Yeah. Right.
It can,
I mean,
also become a substitute.
It can, but it also, and that's where we're going, right? Is substitute. Right. But I think it's important for our listeners to get this because it was, at least for me, and I'm slow and dumb. So, I mean, I you know, maybe I'm the only one, but
no.
I had the impression that it, that AI, particularly GPT chat, right, was going to be a substitute, not a tool or an assistant. And I think that that distinction, tool versus substitute, is very important for us to keep in mind. So,
But here's where we start to get into some problematic areas.
Mm-hmm.
Because if, for example, a scholar is using all his research assistants to read all the papers that are out there, synthesize basic ideas, and then provide even maybe like an outline, and then the guy doesn't go back and check the sources, read them himself, ingest them, incorporate them into his own intellect and mind, and basically own the literature himself.
Right.
We're getting into some problem areas.
No bueno.
It's a possibility that somebody, I think that GPT would spit out a not a good paper, so, but
sure.
You know, in the future, it could maybe do, and no doubt will do a better job. But right now, if you had it, for example, you know, give you ideas on topics, and then you honed the topic to like a thesis statement, even one that was suggested to you, then you asked it for an outline of a paper, and then you went through each point of that outline and asked it to expand those points, citing sources, you know, integrating with, you know, the current literature, whatnot. Like, you could expand it and it would eventually produce
your paper. Yeah.
But that's not your paper in the same way as if you were giving it the ideas to begin with or thinking through it.
Yeah.
And I think it, at least as it is right now, would be extremely noticeable that if someone sat down with you in a room and started to ask you questions about this work and original questions, and you didn't have your computer with you, it would become readily apparent that you didn't think this through or haven't owned it yourself. So your big concern last night was that you might end up with a generation of scholars who don't actually read for themselves.
Right.
They end up using GPT or other forms of artificial intelligence as an entire crutch where you don't read the paper, but you just ask GPT for the answers to the questions you want to know.
Right.
Rather than reading it yourself and then understanding that internally.
Right. And at that point, you're no longer a scholar in any real meaningful sense of the word.
Yeah, you might be some sort of like compiler, or I don't know what you are, but a scholar is not. A
pseudo scholar or something, you know, which is kind of funny because then you become the artificial one, right? You know, you're an artificial scholar, right? You know, where, you know, it, which is kind of ironic, right? You know, maybe we're, you know, with this technology, there is the potential of kind of putting ourselves out of reality, right? And there's a new reality that's arising. Yeah. And that's, I think, what maybe some people are seeing as a potential danger. And at, you know, because at some point, you know, you a scholar has to be able to critically engage this material for themselves and be able to articulate new, fresh ideas for themselves. Otherwise, it's just the computer doing it. Mm-hmm. And at that point, can you really, in any credible sense, take credit for it? And if, you know, if where we want to go as a society or whatever into the future is, look, I don't need to have a name on a book, my name on a book claiming to be the author. I'm happy simply to be the programmer,
the pilot, or whatever, we want to call it.
Yeah. And let AI have the author section of the book or something. You know? Right. I mean, if that's where we want to go, I guess, you know, that's something we need to talk about. But so long as, you know, I can imagine there's going to be a day when people will publish books. And like you were saying earlier about the accreditation on the cover of a book, where there needs to be some sort of a disclosure, you know, this is Jim Cassidy with AI, right? You know, this is Jim Cassidy, but AI has provided the text itself.
I think that's a good thought. I also question at what level is that necessary? Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm with you, but I don't think we need to be doing that if you're using it properly as a tool, you know, to fix your grammar and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But then that gets really complicated as to where have you crossed the line?
The line, right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, and where that line is, I don't think is going to be able to be defined in a
hard way. We should ask AI to tell us.
Let's say, what does AI say? That's right.
Where's the line?
Where's the line? And that's something that academies are going to have to figure out, right?
Right.
You know, when you're training students. And you know they're going to be used. You know, we could get real hardcore, say absolutely no use of AI.
Right.
But is that going to be realistic for where the world? I mean, at one point, it was like, don't use the internet in your research, and then it was like everybody was using the internet in their research.
Not do that.
And then we kind of got smart and said, well, you know what? The internet is a research.
Well, there are places for it and places not. Last night we used a whole bunch of analogies and illustrations in hashing this out. So one of them is Logos, Bible Works, Accordance.
Right.
Like a lot of guys use that. But if you don't actually know your Greek and Hebrew yourself, that's a major problem. But we also don't allow the use of those tools in your Greek exam.
Right.
You know, so, you know, is it cool if we're doing in pastoral ministry, working on our text and we, you know, use these softwares to help us to better and more accurately interpret the text and to exegete it? Yeah. Use them. Check your work. Make sure you're doing it correctly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't want to live in a world in which the guys don't learn the language themselves.
Right.
And they just start going to seminary and don't have any original language training, or all it is software training.
Right.
You know, they need to learn the language. And when we're assessing, we're testing people, they take their quizzes, they take their exams without helps, without any aids. That's not weird.
Yep.
We already live in a world where we're dealing with that.
Yep.
But then the question is, okay, how do we deal with this? We're now potentially, you know, a tool could basically write you a paper, or at least write significant portions of the paper for you.
Mm-hmm.
It makes paper assignments less useful.
Mm-hmm.
I still think we can have a place for essay exams, you know, just any unaided exam in a controlled environment. That's something that is going to last for quite a while.
Yeah.
Until people start getting implants into their brain, then we're going to have another problem where, you know, you're getting fed all this information and there's no way for us to stop it or to control it.
Right.
You know, so then the question is, well, what do we do about this? Well, maybe people are going to have to not assign papers, or we're going to have to treat them differently as something else. Like this, you know, you're basically submitting something that we know, you know, you had a co-pilot for. I don't know. I don't know what that world looks like, but the idea that we could just assign papers or essays that somebody takes home and works on over the course of a few months and comes back, the idea that we could expect any of those things to be 100% authored by, you know, the person turning it in, I just don't see that as reasonable. I don't even know if we should stop people from using all these tools. Do we prevent them from using spell check? Well, no, because what we actually care about is not whether they know how to spell. That's in service of communicating their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know the answers to these questions, but it's an interesting way to think.
Well, I mean, spell check's an interesting
yeah.
case study, right? Because with spell check, part of the problem with spell check is that in many ways it has made us all poor spellers, right? And if we don't have spell check at our disposal, it's like we become bumbling idiots when we're writing.
I think a lot of people. I'm a weirdo though. I think I spell just fine without.
Well, that may be you. The rest of us, however, we struggle.
Exalt myself, but I just say there's a sliver of the population that's just finicky about those things.
Sure, yeah, but I mean, you know, so has it collectively, not for sure. Spelling Bee, sure. You know, winners sure. Like yourself, but I mean, you know, for the rest
never,
of us,
never done that. Yeah.
You know, has it in fact made us? Yeah. Lazy in
sure.
Terms of spelling.
That's when tool goes to crutch.
Right. And you could say the same thing, quite frankly, about the typed text too, mm-hmm. Right? Like we have given up on handwriting completely, right?
Yeah.
Well, not completely, but almost. Yet they still teach it in the lower grades and whatnot, but nobody's expected to handwrite their seminary papers
Correct.
Anymore.
Correct.
And I think that's, you know, I think that that's a movement in the right yeah. Direction. I mean, I don't think we want to go back to that world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's just recent, right? Like Westminster moved away from actually using the blue books for their exams to, you know, I mean, in some classes, right? You know, where you used to handwrite. And,
when I taught, I would let people use a computer, but they weren't allowed to use other helps, you know?
Right. Yeah. But they could use a Word
document.
I did
that on the honor code. But I much preferred getting typed out thoughts.
Yeah.
That they could move
as a teacher.
They move their sentence around. Like I liked reading those better than reading the stream of consciousness scribbles that I would get from a blue book.
Oh, I mean, could you imagine, you know, my poor professor, because I have terrible handwriting. I mean, the answers they had to read over the years that I was putting down, I mean, with that chicken scratch that I have, it's just terrible.
It's all in order too, or there you get to like the last page and it's like, oh, insert this between paragraphs.
Yeah.
Like you're coming up with other ideas, at least with a word processor. You can move it
right.
Anyway, but that's there's an epistemological change with the word processor.
Sure.
Don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
Yeah,
we need to get going to this game because they're not going to wait for us. however, we need to talk about the ministry. We need to talk about sermon preparation. We need to talk about where the line is here. So, what are your thoughts on this? On the unethical use and then the abuse of artificial intelligence in sermon prep, in, you know, order of worship prep, all that.
Yeah, I would say I have less than 24 hours of which I've been thinking about this. So, I mean, take my thoughts for whatever little they may be worth. You know, I mean, in one respect, this has been a problem for many years, right? Because pastors have been downloading sermons off of the internet for, you know, this.
Now that's straight up plagiarism.
That's straight up plagiarism.
Or you're buying one that already exists.
Right.
But I think that's way over the line, mm-hmm. A little bit different, a lot different from AI, but I think,
and whatever you call it, it's sort of cheating, right?
I mean, it's totally cheating.
Yeah. Because the people in the pews are expecting that you're not going to just, you know, like they want to hear what God has to say, right, through you, the man who, that, filled with the Spirit.
It's a high and holy calling into just like, phone it in under the guise that you're doing this is appalling.
Yeah, that I mean, that's exactly right. And I think that when we think about our theology, I mean, we have to think about our theology of preaching, okay? So what does it mean that God calls fallible, fallen, sinful men, redeemed by grace, to bring the word of God to his people, right? And does that mean, you know, is there a place for God to use AI as the carrier or the medium by which the word is going to come to God's people?
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't find a biblical anthropology that allows that, right?
See people staying at home and just talking to the AI, like in the movie Her. And then, you know, telling it its problems and then say, you know, preach to me about this.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Is that preaching?
Right.
No, I don't think so. But, you know, let's use some tamer examples. Let's say you wrote your sermon.
Yeah.
You're trying to come up with hymns that are applicable. You type in the prompt. You say, you know, I really want a hymn that relates to passage X, Y, Z that is on the theme of repentance. It's preferable that this would be, you know, maybe a minor key hymn or something that is quiet and is more subdued. And it's going to come right after the call to repentance and the declaration of pardon or before the call to repentance, whatever. You get right. the idea. You mm-hmm. can set that stage for the thing. It will spit out good examples to you.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't replace your own thoughts. You need to understand the hymns and get good yeah. at music yeah. yourself, yep. hopefully, so that you can truly lead worship and guide mm-hmm. people in, you know, worshiping and serving the Lord. But, you know, if you're asking it for some ideas, then mm-hmm. I'd say by all means do that. But if you're saying, hey, my sermon is on Hebrews 12, 1 through 4, write my order of worship. Mm-hmm. And then you just copy that and send it to the church secretary. Mm-hmm. I think we got a major problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you are a shepherd, right? Yeah. And part of being a shepherd is shepherding the people of God in worship, as you mm-hmm. were indicating. And if you are having the congregation sing hymns that you yourself have not first read and understood and know what content is in those hymns,
yeah,
I mean, that's irresponsible, right? Because it may have, especially if you're trying to edify. I mean, we don't pick hymns because it's edifying to the congregation first and foremost. We pick the hymns because it's glorifying to God. But also, we pick the hymns that we pick because yeah. it's edifying to the people of God, right? So we don't pick the hymns irrespective of the edification of the congregation. Yeah. How do we know that that particular hymn is going to edify that particular congregation on that particular Sunday in light of that particular message from God's word, right? You got to have a person who actually is a shepherd that knows the people and that knows the hymns, that knows the sermon, and that, you know, so forth and so on. The kind of thing that artificial intelligence, at least at this point, cannot actually process. And I think that, you know, when it comes to sermon prep, I'm fully on board with everything you're saying here. I think because we use all sorts of helps, okay? I open up my Trinity Psalter Hymnal app when yeah, I'm trying to
totally.
Pick hymns.
Do word search.
And
absolutely.
I do a search. Yeah. You know, if I'm talking about...
I use the scripture reference or index in the back yeah. all the time. All yeah. the time.
Right. Yeah.
It'd be exactly. dumb not to.
It'd be dumb not to. Right. Yeah. The alternative is to start from hymn one, or Psalm one, you know, and then go through
or just,
until...
Or just pick your favorites regardless of what the text is dealing with.
Or the yeah. ones that... Yeah, yeah. Or go that route as well. And you That's could go that too. Route. That's not necessarily... But I mean, you know, you know, it again, it's the difference between using it as a tool versus using it as a substitute. Because if All you right. begin to justify the substitute,
yeah.
at what point do we have robots, you know, when the technology advances, right? Standing behind a pulpit, right. delivering sermons that are probably going to be much better than anything I could preach.
Let me do a rapid fire round here to yep. to finish things off. So we really got to get moving. We're already late. Especially if we want to get there at the time we wanted to get there. Yep. Okay. So you give a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and I'm going to force you into this. And are you okay with this, or is this over the line?
Okay.
You're really struggling for an historical narrative that illustrates a particular point. You fully describe the point that you want to make theologically, and you ask it for any stories from history that illustrate that point. Okay, you got it. So Jim gave a thumbs up there. That's okay. let's see here. You have it right. You plug in a text, you know, text reference or the whole text, and then you say, come up with my outline. And it spits out an outline down. Okay, Jim's not cool with that. I'm not cool with that either, because you're not really exegeting it. You know, you're not letting the text and your own understanding of the text drive the
yeah,
issue.
Yeah, because the outline is going to be determined by so many factors.
Yeah, yeah
that AI pastorally that right. AI can't figure out. Yeah.
Okay, last one. I'll ask you. It's a bit weird. You pre-feed it a whole host of sermons from your favorite preacher. You write your own sermon. Your own exegesis, your own illustrations and all that, but then you feed it through the system and you say, make my sermon better by rewriting it in the voice of my favorite preacher.
because, you know,
what's worse is you take someone else's sermon and you have it rewrite it in your voice.
Yeah, that is worse. My congregation would give that thumbs up, I think, because they'd be like, you know, oh, please, you know, anything to improve the preaching here. Oh, yeah. Goodness. But, you know, but I mean, that's You're a terrible. Temptation, isn't it? Right. Because right. everybody wants to have a great sermon on Sunday, but it's like we have limited capacity. But God ordains the weak things of this world in order to give him the glory. And if we start trying to maximize, you know, primacy in preaching as if, you know, we're man-made effects, that's just not good. It's not logical.
It's going to get even weirder. I was talking to a guy, VP of development, I think, or business growth or something at an AI company that is working with churches. I'm going to be talking to him just out of curiosity. Got a meeting scheduled with him. Real fascinating guy. Nice guy. I met him at a conference. But their company is looking at using AI to uncover people's motivations based on their own stories. So people could like just describe what they want to do in life or describe, you know, what they love about church and how they want to engage. And then the AI will kind of uncover like what their motivations are and try to get at their specific suitability for different volunteer tasks and whatnot. That's
like an
that's
AI
wild.
Shrink.
Yeah. So here's what, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to frighten everyone and scare everyone and leave them with this. Somebody out there, some evangelical marketer is going to do this and it's going to start spying, not this company. I don't want to disparage a company. I'm actually intrigued by what they do for business purposes. Like, you know, job placement, stuff like that. Like just have a kid tell you what they love and then say, oh, actually like you might be suitable for these kinds of jobs, whatever. But some evangelical marketer out there, pastor is going to do this, like a psychologist, and is going to start, you know, hoovering up, vacuuming up like the US, like the CIA does for American output and start reading everyone's tweets, Instagram posts, every of their congregation. And use AI to find out what the specific emotional pain points are. Then it's going to start writing and crafting sermons and illustrations that deal with the specific emotions and pain points that their people have based on what their artificial intelligence, like their recon, has been finding.
Oh, good grief.
It sounds terrible, doesn't it?
Oh, man. No need for pastoral visits anymore. Oh, man. Good night.
Scary. It is not implausible. Oh, I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying from a technological standpoint, it's not that hard to imagine.
Look,
that
man,
happening.
I'll tell you what, the Mets better win tonight because I don't feel real good about myself.
Well, let's go.
Right now.
Let's go down to Murphy's. Let's go hit Murphy's up. We'll visit some of the haunted, the wonderful establishments, and we'll both yearn for better days for our baseball clubs. But you know, we've both picked teams that are suitable for a pilgrim people, and we'll take it from there. I want to let everyone know you check out reformforum.org for all the information and updates about things coming out. Please subscribe to the email newsletter. That's where you're going to find most of the information in a timely fashion. But if you got any questions, you can email us at mail@reformedforum.org. And we hope to hear from you. I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.